You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thord,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Mel Odom.
At the end of the show, we're going to have an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War. This audio clip is narrated by the one and only Luke Daniels. You're going to love this series. I love it so much. And Richard has been a great supporter and sponsor of the show, and we're going to show him some love. Listen to the audiobook excerpt. You're going to love it. And be sure to go to audible.com to purchase it. If you're not an Audible subscriber, you can get a free book just by signing up for a free trial at audibletrial.com/Hank. You get a 30-day free trial. You get the free book. If you decide to cancel your Audible subscription, you get to keep the free book, and it doesn't cost you a single penny. audibletrial.com/Hank, and listen after the show for the clip from Richard Fox.
Writers, I have an amazing tool to tell you about. A revolutionary writing tool for planning stories, Campfire Pro is what novelists need to go from the seed of an idea to a detailed plan that's ready to be executed. Complete your character design, create a timeline, and track your world building all in one place with our downloadable desktop app for Mac and PC. Without the annoying subscription model so many apps are using today, visit campfiretechnology.com for special holiday pricing on Campfire Pro today. Who Wants to Love a Billionaire? Billionaires in New York, Book 1 by Laura Burton. Do you have a favorite writer whose books are auto-buys for you? Wouldn't you love for readers to have you on their auto-buy list, then recommend your books to their friends and on social media? The good news is there are subtle things you can do, things that are nearly invisible to the reader, that will make your stories unputdownable. The Beyond 10 Days course from Victory Editing can help you get the most from your stories and help you build that relationship with readers through your writing. This course is full of awesome, and best of all, you don't have to fly across the country or put on pants. In this course, we'll focus on avoiding info dumps, dialogue mechanics, show versus tell in dialogue, carrying show versus tell forward to your narrative, deepening your point of view and strengthening your protagonist's voice, overwriting and how to avoid it. 10 hours of video content with text and audio downloads. Shine that diamond. Join me at the Beyond 10 Days course. Go to HankGarner.com and click the banner to sign up today. The Forsaken Mercenary series by Jonathan Yanez, a near future thriller series, is now available on Audible.com. The series that readers have loved is now available in your favorite format, audiobook format. The first book is called Dropship in the Forsaken Mercenary series. If they can't control him, they'll try and kill him. Daniel Hunt is the deadliest mercenary in the galaxy, if he can just remember. 5 years before, he woke up with nothing more than his name. Now his present is on a violent collision with his past and the future of the galaxy. The Earth is dead. Humanity is taken to the Moon and Mars to have a chance. On what's left of Earth, primal gangs war for dominance. A rebel force will discover a weapon of unimaginable strength. The wealthy in the galaxy will do anything to possess. As Daniel unravels the origin of his past, he'll realize he's not the same weapon he once was. But does redemption exist for someone like him? For fans of Jason Bourne and the Weapon X program, this one's for you. Grab your hand cannon and start listening now. The Forsaken Mercenary series, Book 1 Dropship, available on Audible.com now from Jonathan Yanez. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have Mel Odom on the show with me today. He has a phenomenal new book. It's called Warlord, and it's the Macomb War, Book 3. Mel, I absolutely love this book. I love what you're doing with the series.
People will be very familiar with you and your work, even if they don't know that they are. I think we'll dig into all the great stuff you're involved with. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah, excited to have you, Mel. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, that one's easy. That one stands out because I was, I think, 6, and I first started learning how to write, and I was the oldest of 4 children at the time. My mother ended up having 5 boys, but I was always the adventurous kid and always went outside to go do things when she wasn't looking at age 5 and 6, which made it hard for her to manage when she had a baby in arms and everything else, so she couldn't keep up with me. So she found the only way she could keep me around the house was to read to me. So there used to be a flip book. She would flip one side, and it was The Christmas Carol. It was Robinson Crusoe, Swiss Family Robinson, all these old books. And Mom would read to me with babies in arms. And she would keep me nailed in the room with her. She read Pinocchio and all the other things she read. So I lived on stories. And later, when I got comic books, my dad would stop. He'd come home and get me from school, and he'd give me a quarter so I could buy 2 piece of gum. And she would read those to me from cover to cover. And then later, after she finished, I would read them back to her. And as I learned how to write and put words together, because we had Dick and Jane and Fun with Tip and all these other things, I started writing stories myself. So I've been writing stories since I first learned this language, and just hopefully gotten better.
That's amazing. 5 sons, God lover. Had to be a challenge.
It was a household.
Did your parents or a school teacher, anyone along the way, kind of recognize the storytelling gene that you had and kind of encourage you in writing stories?
Well, actually, my mom and dad kind of did, but they had all these kids, and neither one of them finished high school, and so they weren't really into reading. My mother read occasionally. My father was illiterate, and she used to read Luke Short's books to him to try to hope build up his vocabulary and stuff. But I had a teacher in 3rd grade, Mrs. Knight, and I'm ADHD, been ADHD all my life. There's no cure. You just wear it and move on. Luckily, I've trained it to be my mutant ability. I'm interested in many things, so I do many things. But Mrs. Knight would come to me because I would talk to other people in class after I finished my work. And she'd go, "You need to finish your work." And I go, "It's done." And she goes, "You need to check it over." And I said, "It's all right." So she'd check it over. It was all right. And she goes, "Okay." She goes, "You need to read the books in law." And she goes, "This one?" And I said, "Yes, the Greek mythology." That was the first one. Then she had a collection of orange and black history books, and I can't remember what they were called, but I read about James Oglethorpe and James Audubon and all this stuff. So I've got a big love of history, and I think it came out of those orange and black books. But what she did, and I don't know if they had garage sales back then. I'm 62. So she brought this big box of books. Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew, Tracy Belden, Rover Bull, everything. And she goes, "Look, when you're finished your work, come back to the closet and you can pick up one of these books and read it." So I got to read in class, which made me kind of special. And so on days that I was good, I got to take a book home. And all those books are written with cliffhanger endings. So if I didn't do well in class, I'd get to take a book home. But, you know, the worst day of all to really screw up was Fridays, because you spent the whole weekend wondering if Frank and Joe were going to fall off the cliff. So on weekends, she let me take 2 or 3 books home, and I'd have them all read by Monday. And later, when I was in 10th grade, I was new to high school. I went to school at Bing. And I was new and didn't know anybody, and very introverted by nature. And so I didn't get to know people. And I used to write in Mrs. Todd's class. And so she goes, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm writing," because she thought I was goofing off. And I said, "Well, I'm writing. I've got all the work done, so I'm writing." And she goes, "What are you writing?" And I said, "This." And so she read it. And she goes, "When you finish this, let me have it." I said, "Okay." So I wrote about a 20-page short story, private detective thing. And she read it and gave me notes and everything else on it. And she goes, "You can do this if you really want to." And that was the first time, you know, Mrs. Knight kind of fostered the reading stuff, which has been a grace all my life. But Mrs. Todd really stepped forward. And I've never gotten to see her since I became successful. And I always wanted to go back and talk to her, because she was gone the very next semester, because she was pregnant with a baby at that time. And at that time, pregnant women had to be hidden at school, so you couldn't just be out and be pregnant. And so I always wondered if she ever found out what I'd done. So that's who got me started.
I love asking that question because invariably almost everyone has a story similar to you, that is crystal clear in their memory. And, you know, because writing can be, you know, such a solitary pursuit. We spend a lot of time alone, not interacting with people, as we were joking about before we started recording, you know, not having talked to people yet, you know, this morning. And that little bit of encouragement from someone who, you know, it didn't matter to their life one way or another whether she encouraged you or not. You know, yep. she went on about her business, like, but you've held on to that all those years. And it's so amazing that little piece of encouragement sticks with us and can really help us make it through some of those dark, lonely times.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the reasons I teach at the University of Oklahoma, and I'm teaching in a profession which has been around since the 1930s. Dwight Swain, Jack Bickham, Guy Foster Harris went all the way back to the 1930s and started this program. And I always keep that in mind when I teach kids, that I make sure that they turn their homework in on time, make sure that they do what I wanted them to do. But I always try to be encouraging along the way, too, because that little bit of encouragement goes a long, long way.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Mel, when you graduated high school and went off to college, did you know that you were on this writing path? And did you study things in college that you felt like would help you get down that path?
No, not really, because I graduated in high school and I went to college because my mom and dad wanted a college graduate. I didn't know what I was doing. I went to school and I wanted to be a writer. That's all I've ever wanted to do, but I grew up in Oklahoma. My father raised pigs, so I grew up around farm boy stuff, and, you know, daddy was too cheap to even buy a water hose, so I had to carry 5-gallon buckets of water to off the animals and stuff. So I grew up in that, and I was reading Isaac Asimov at the time and Robert Heinlein and Andre Norton, and I was like, you know, they didn't start like this. And so I thought I would never get to be a writer. So I went to college to learn how to write, and all they had were English, you know, English teacher classes. So I learned a lot about grammar, which has been beneficial along the way. But I fell in love with history. And so I double majored in English and history and had more history classes than anything. And history, if it's taught by the right professor, is all story. And so I still love history to this day. My 22-year-old is going to college right now. His major's in history because he and I share that love. But that kind of prepared me, but I never thought I would make it as a writer. So I was just, you know, I wrote a novel every summer in between college courses and stuff like that. And I would box it in a typing paper box and put it on a shelf and forget about it because I knew I would never get to be a writer. So, no, I prepared myself. I'm an autodidact. I teach myself everything I pretty much need to know. So I taught myself about writing, but I never thought I'd get the chance.
I love the idea of studying history, and even if you didn't feel like it at the time, that obviously has had a big impact on your writing career, hasn't it?
Yes, because the way that stories are structured even in history follow a similar path, and they're linear, so you have to learn how to do that.
Right. Do you give that sort of advice to young writers? Do you think it's important to study the craft of writing, or do you think it's more important, or are they not mutually exclusive? Do you feel like it's important to study things to write about or to study the act of writing? Or does it have to be one or the other?
No, it has to be both. They have to be conjoined things. You cannot just study the craft, because if you study the craft, you have nothing to write about. If you go live life and you have a bunch of stories to tell, unless you know how to tell them, you're not going to get them out there. So you have to do both. And that's what I tell my kids. You've got to live life and you got to study craft. One of the videos that recently broke on Facebook gave me an epiphany about things. I've got kids who are in this program who love to write but have never read very much. And I got kids who've read a lot but haven't really spent that much time writing. So I get different skill levels all over the place. But there was a video that came out this weekend I saw that really opened my eyes to the thought. I don't know if you've seen it. There's a video of this 60-year-old woman who dances Uptown Funk with her high school kids. That's
I haven't
been all
seen
over
that.
The internet. You haven't seen that?
Okay, I haven't. I guess I've been under a rock.
Oh, you have?
No, I have not.
Well, I watched the video and I thought, oh, cool. That's, you know, there's this woman that's dancing with her kids and she's matching them move for move. I mean, she's elegant. She is just really good at what she's doing. And the moves are all there. The choreography's tight and everything else. And I thought, God, that's awesome. Look at this old woman dancing. And somebody down below in the comments said, you people are looking at an old woman who's learned how to dance hip hop with these kids and stuff like that. What you don't realize is that is a lifelong dancer. And all she's done is take the skills that she knows and blended them with these kids. And I thought, that's what makes a writer. A writer who's really a gifted writer is someone who is a lifelong reader. And that, I just opened my eyes. I never thought about it that way. So I talked to the other writing professors, because I teach with Jennifer Barnes and Deborah Chester and Mariana Evans at the college. And I said, look at this. And so we all agreed that we had not thought about that before, the fact that you got somebody with a lifelong skill that turned it into something. So now it makes perfect sense. I teach reading classes to my kids at OU because they don't read enough, you know, and you can't just say, oh, I have an interesting story.
That's a fantastic answer. So from your time in college, you began publishing in the late 80s. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yep.
There was I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to ask you, what was the path to get there?
Oh, well, there was a guy I met in Oklahoma City. He did Mike McQuay, and he did Escape from New York, the novelization. He did a couple of Matthew Swain, Private Detective of the 20s, futuristic science fiction stuff. And so I ended up getting to meet him, and I went and talked to him, and I found out from him that the Mac Bolan Executioner series was looking for writers, which I grew up reading those. My mom didn't know about the sex in them. She thought they were just advanced cowboy and western kind of things. So anyway, there's things you just don't tell your mom. But anyway, I went, and so he gave me the editor's name, who contacted and everything, so I sent a package off to them, and they rejected it. But they told me, did it look really good? Could I send them more outlines? So I sent four more outlines. They rejected all four of them and said, look, keep trying, because we really need writers and you're really close. So I took the best one of those four, and I thought, you know, at that point it was kind of irritating. I thought, I don't know how to tell stories. So I went took the one out of them I thought was the best. I wrote 120-something pages on it and sent it in, and I go, look, I've been reading this character for forever. I really like writing. It's what I've always wanted to do. Here's this. So Feroz Muhammad, who was the editor at that time, called me back in October. And he said, Mel, if you can finish, because he had an accent, I can't do the accent, right? I do it among friends because that's, you know, okay. But he had an accent. Here's his phone call. He goes, Mel, and I got to record. This is back when you had to play the cassette tape back. So I got this recording. He goes, Mel, if you can finish this damn thing, we'll buy it. And I'm like, okay, there's a challenge. And so I was going to turn 30 on December 16th. So I finished that thing up from October to December 15th. Got it in the mail on December 15th, and they bought it on Elvis's birthday, January 8th, the following month. So that was how I got started, and I did over 30 books in that series and a bunch of other stuff for them.
That is insane. Now that you've written a lot of books in different series, and you've done your own standalone books, can you talk a little bit about the difference in the creative process in writing, you know, in an existing property versus, you know, Mel Odom dreaming everything up, the world building and all of that? Do you approach them differently? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the thing of it is when you start working in somebody else's fields, I've worked in Forgotten Realms and I've done all kinds of things, Shadowrun. There's a lot of things I've done. You step into their world, they've got a bunch of guidebooks and they're all set up a certain way. And I kind of do my detective work, and I look at this really big world they created, and I find one small corner of it I want to work in, and all the rules that go with that one small corner. Because a lot of people think that I really know everything about these worlds, and I don't. But because I look at this microcosm of it, it really spins out of everything, and it shows everything else in the world. So when I started creating my own world, I used those maps that I was given by these other books and stuff that they sent me, how the worlds were laid out. So you're constrained by someone else's world. And it's just like the Star Trek writers and stuff. You know, you can go play with the toys and stuff like that, but once you're at the end of the story, all the toys have to be back neatly on the shelf and nothing has to be changed. In your own theory, you can change things. So there's some blessings to the fact that if they've already got all the stuff there, you don't have to dig up and create anything. It's all yours, except you can take some tweaks and turns and twists with it. But when you're creating your own thing, there's a lot of freedom, but there's a lot of work that goes into figuring all that stuff out. So for me, I love both. I love walking into a world and doing what I can with it, and I love creating worlds. And so they're similar, but they are different.
Do you, when you're taking on a project, have you ever come up on one where, it was just kind of like the rules that they provided you were too stifling, or do you always find some way that you can find that corner where you can make your mark and it doesn't feel like that it's, the process is wooden maybe?
Well, the thing of it is, I had 5 kids of my own. So if it had a paycheck involved, I figured out a way to do it. I have never, that's like a lot of people that look, if they actually go look at everything I've done Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I've done Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and they're like, Mel, how do you write middle grade teenage witch books and stuff? And I'm like, there's a lot of money that went into those books. It didn't take much time. And I like the television show. Plus, I have kids. And right now, I have college kids who keep me very young and in their world. So I never really found anything. Now, there were some projects that were harder than others because they were more stringent about, no, you can't do this, no, you can't do that. But, Hank, I've always found a way because I needed a way. And the thing of it is, I've never let pride get in the way of a paycheck. So it's, because I work for my kids. That's what I've always done. And so there's no, until my kids can eat my pride, I'm not going to try to sell my pride.
There you go. My wife and I have 5 kids as well, and pride is not something we've been afforded.
You can't put that on the table. You cannot put that on the table.
You cannot. And at the end of the day, if you take a job that you're not super excited about, but it's a paycheck, and at the end of the day, you're still telling stories. I mean, isn't that what we all wanted to do in the beginning, is we wanted to tell stories? Okay, so what? Where, it may not be the thing we're most excited for. It's a whole lot bigger than a whole lot better than digging ditches. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Well, the thing of it is, with me, I'm ADHD. So by the time I get halfway through a book, I'm like, oh, but the next one's going to be so much better. So that's where the self-discipline kicks in. And I've had to tell my kids at school, they go, well, because I've got kids, I teach novel every semester, and halfway through, they're like groaning and going, I should have done something else. And I said, no, this is normal. Well, I don't know what I'm doing. That's normal. Because all these things are normal. And so I've had to learn how to be self-disciplined to that. But I also allow myself, Stephen King has what he calls his toy truck time. And it's either 1 o'clock or 3 o'clock or 2 o'clock or 4 o'clock, or at least it was when he wrote the article. And he takes off time during that part of the day, and he writes whatever he wants to. And that's where we got a different seasons came out of these blow off stories that he was doing, a lot of the short novellas and stuff he did. So I always have files opened up on different projects I want to do eventually. And I take time. I don't nail myself to this one thing forever, but I'll take time and I'll go create something else. So I remember that I've got to play to the worker, the blue collar part of me, and then to the artist part of me too. So I make sure both of those get fed.
I love it. I love it. Mel, are you, as prolific as you've been and as busy as your schedule stays, are you a planner when it comes to your writing projects, or are you a discovery writer? What's your mode to keeping the train on the tracks?
I write a talking document, what I call a talking document. And I think somebody else may have called it before or something. But what I do is usually a 10 or 20 page outline of the book, the characters and everything else. And I go from point A to point B and delineate everything I need to, all the high points and stuff like that. And I still leave myself room to be creative. I garden all the time, too. I lay out my gardens. I do raised beds and stuff. But I always have spaces in between that I can do other things with, or experiment with other things, because I get bored. I can't do the same thing all the time. So I always leave myself room, but I make sure I have a map, that I have a path that I can follow all the way through. And if I ever get an idea that's really good and it takes me somewhere else, I stop and I re-outline from that point on and re-outline the rest of the book to make sure it makes sense. I've always planned. The best book I've ever found on that is a book by James Scott Bell called Superstructure. It's about 120 pages long, and it has 14 signposts. And if you go look at any Marvel movie, those 14 signposts are there. And it's one of the ones that it's the main book I teach out of kids, because they've had books that in the past I grew up on several writing books, Lawrence Block stuff and other things. But this is the one that's most simply laid out for the kids to understand. They don't have to go, well, I don't even know who these people are. But it's written, and it talks about Wizard of Oz and movies they're very familiar with. So I plan. I do not ever just sit down. I have occasionally sit down and done that. And if it's a story that really captures me, a character that really captures me, I do not allow that to wander off. I go, okay, I got something here. Now it's time to sit down and write an outline. the longest outline I ever did, there was a book I called Hunters of the Dark Sea, which I got fascinated by whaling in the early 1800s. And my agent, I sent the outline into him, and he goes, Mel, this is 107 pages long. I said, yes. And he goes, you should have just went ahead and wrote the book. I said, well, that's next. But I wanted all the detail, all the background, all the research I'd done on that story and everything needed to be in there. And I didn't want to have to look for it somewhere else twice. So,
gotcha. Well, you know, you mentioned Stephen King earlier in that toy truck time. He famously said in his book on writing, you know, that he's a pantser or a discovery writer or a gardener, whichever term you want to use. And he's very adamantly against outlining. And he says it's like writing the book twice. Do you ever feel that way? When I meet someone who is an avid outliner, they always, kind of look crooked when you mention that Stephen King quote, because they don't feel like that at all. Do you ever get that way?
No, I don't, because it's like kissing a girl once and you go, okay, I'm not sure if I did that right. Can I kiss you again to make sure I did it right? So you can get away with that when you were younger.
You're right.
But, I learn more the second time through. Stephen King, I love Stephen King stuff. That quote I throw in my kids' faces all the time. If you don't have time to read, you have either time or tools to write. And I believe it's true. But, some of his books I really just loved, like Doom the Key. I loved that book, and it was so off and just different. And there's a character in there called Wireman that Bruce Campbell should play. But he's got some stuff that's really good. And I just finished up The Institute over the Christmas break. And I don't know if you've read it, but there was a part in the middle I had to sit down and go, okay, I've got to sit down and read. And I had to spend the whole day reading, not because it was so good, but just so I could get through that part because it was wash, rinse, and repeat. And that's one of the things that he gets into, and he is able to do that in a long run because he does have a story there. But not everybody gets that pass. I tried reading The Outsider, which I heard is doing really well in the television series now, but I couldn't get through The Outsider. Joyland, one of the best books I think he's ever written, and I know that one was pantsed, and but it works really well. He is an innate craft retailer. I mean, he knows what he's doing. But he even had a quote in there one time that when he does novels, it's kind of like extracting the Egyptian urn out of the sand. Sometimes they break, because he kind of digs around and tries to find things. But I try to plan things because I don't have time to break them when I'm feeding 5 kids.
Right, right. Well, and he even kind of poked fun at himself. I don't know if you saw the new remakes of It, the part one and part two.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, in the second part, Stephen King has that great cameo where he's working in the little shop, and he's got that book, and he talks about the endings. That's kind of the running joke all the way through the movie is that I forget the actor who plays the writer in the movie, but there's always this joke about his endings suck, and
yep.
And then Stephen King kind of pitches that there, and I think that's kind of a subtle joke in that sometimes he lands them, sometimes he doesn't.
Well, that's just like the guy who steps into the batter's box. If you hit one time out of three, you got an excellent record. And with
right.
the storyteller, not everybody gets that grace because you are your greatest failure. But King is enough, and he doesn't let it slow him down. He doesn't stop because, he keeps doing what he's doing because he's even tried to retire at one point, and he can't do it because he's doing what he loves. And that's why I keep showing up every day to teach. I never thought I would like to teach, but I do. And I'm constantly here for stories. And then when the garden kicks in, I work all the time. I like to stay busy.
Yeah. Mel, me doing this podcast, and we've got over 800 episodes now. This feeds me in a way, that nothing else does, just getting to talk to creative people and talk about storytelling, it just kind of keeps the fire lit. And, you always learn something. There's always some little nugget that you can pull away from, but even more than that, it's just the camaraderie of storytellers just does something for me that nothing else does. Is teaching like that for you, being in that creative environment and helping other people find their path? What do you, as a creative person, get out of teaching?
Well, the thing of it is, when I read other people's work, I can look at mine more closely because I've learned a lot editing other students' work. that I go back with a different set of eyes when I go back and look at my own work. So I've taught myself quite a bit through teaching. And that's one of the things I think, they always have that old saying, if you really want to learn something, teach it. Because people that you're in contact with are going to ask you questions you will not think of on your own. You will not understand why you do what you do until somebody asks you, and you have to sit down and go, why do I do what I do? And then you have an answer, and all of a sudden it puts a floor under a lot of other things and connects a lot of other things that you've been doing. So I think I gain more insight. You know, here I am giving knowledge, but what I'm getting is all the insight into my process because I'm having to teach my process. So I think that helps me a lot. And the camaraderie, I went to BoucherCon, it's the first convention I've been to in a while in Dallas. Max Allen Collins was there, and Robert J. Randese, and guys that I've known that talked to over email. I met Max BoucherCon, but my son Charlotte was with me. He lived in Houston, so he came up to Dallas with me. And I got to introduce him to a lot of the writers, Paul Bishop and James Reasoner, a lot of guys that were there. And so Joe Lansdale, we hung out with Joe, because Joe and I like each other. We don't spend much time together. But Shiloh got to meet them, and he was really surprised at how many people knew me. And I said, well, Shiloh, actually, I'm kind of well known. You guys just never, you guys just don't look at me that way. But when I got to talk to those writers, and Shiloh had turned 30. He's a manager at Dave and Buster's down in Houston, and he loves what he does. He's been passionate about being in food for 16 years. And he goes, Dad, you're the same way about this that I am about restaurant work. I said, yes, you go to where your passion is. I said, you guys have never had the chance to really see me among my peers. And so he goes, I love this. He goes, you do it again next year. And so we're going to Las Vegas this year for the 20 books thing that they've got, the digital stuff. And he goes, when you go, take me. And I said, okay. So he's, yeah, it's just, if you find the passion, even if you don't understand someone else's passion, Hank, you understand passion. And that's why you hang out with people.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, let's talk about the new book, the new series, The Macomb War is the new series. Warlord is the third book in that. What a fantastic book. And I love that it's in mass market paperback. It's like 500 pages of mass market paperback, like all of the great sci-fi that I grew up reading. Where did this series come from? And kind of just set up the, you know, what this book's about, what's the world about, and what's the initial catalyst for the story?
Well, my agent and I were looking around for something new to do, and he talked about, you know, military science fiction being so big. And the fact that I had such a deep background in men's action adventure, he goes, no, you should really do something like this. And so I sat down, and Ethan and I kicked some things back and forth, and we ended up with Frank Sage, and he was a guy trying to get back in the war after he'd been furloughed out pretty much to go train. Because guys, you're really in, you know, a lot of military guys, and you don't want to be on the sidelines unless you have family and stuff like that. And even then, some of those guys don't want to be. So we came up with this, and what I had was a little out-of-the-way world that the war was approaching, and no one knew for sure it was going to go there. And it does. And when it arrives, Frank Sage is ready. And out of all these green troops and everything that are on that world, Frank Sage is the one to try to pull everything together. And there's politics where nobody really cares. Everybody's really willing to abandon the world. But there's this group of people, Macomb people, that were crash-landed on there like 400 years ago. And they're living there. And he does not want to leave them. And it's that, and they have the Frenorians, who are these scorpion-like people that are almost like a Asian warlord, you know, mentality. And it's just that juxtaposition of that. And I just had a lot of fun with that world, and everything is on the line by the time we get to the third book. And it got long, and I really, you said it's some pages long, and I just knew when I sent that thing in, I could not cut it down. I've gone over it a couple times. It actually was longer at one point. So I cut it down as well as I could, and I sent it into my editor. And I really thought they were going to go, no, it's too long, which if you do digital, it's fine. But I really sell paperback. I sell pretty well in too. And I thought this is going to kill the paperback kind of thing. And instead, they went ahead and published. They looked at it because David Pomerico looked at it and goes, got this. So let's run with it. And so I was really surprised, but there you go. There it is.
I love it. The Macomb War. How did you start envisioning this conflict that the world found itself in? Kind of, you know, when you start thinking about a new story like this, and you've got, you know, got this character, and you kind of feel out his situation and where he is, how do you start thinking about the overarching conflict that you're going to thrust everyone into?
Well, that, I just looked at the, you know, we have Vietnam. I grew up during the Vietnam era and stuff too. The draft ended two years before I turned 18. So we were very aware of all that. Everything's going over there, the drugs, just all the bad things at work. So I try to use, you know, I try to inflict and visit as much of that onto my column as I could, because I felt like that's where the stories were, you know, with people and people getting trapped between. And there's one of the women in there who's one of the council women on the comm that really was a friend this age. And I tried to do as much of that. And so it's kind of a blend of all the wars, because we got the war in Afghanistan still going on. That's been longer now than any American war before. And I really tried to visit war, but I tried to visit on a small scale. I created it big in my mind, in the Terran for Norian war. But I wanted to talk about Frank Sage's war. And so I, you know, we're going to have these big conflicts, I think, off and on throughout probably the rest of our lives. And they're never going to truly go away. And there's people who fought in it. And we've got all the PTSD stuff that's coming out now. We've got all the concussive blasts that's affecting brains and things. So we're still finding out all this stuff. But I just tried to bring our war into space, I think, kind of sort of with the people. It's very much Audie Murphy. It's very much the hero kind of thing, because you can't get away from that in fiction. But I just looked at the fact that war is everywhere. Once it's on a place, it just goes everywhere. And there's all kinds of things, side markets, black markets, everything that comes in to follow. They used to, in the old days, I don't know if you're familiar with the term camp followers.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so these people made a habit of following the warriors into battle so that they could strip all the goods off the dead. So that's kind of, you know, you've always got that kind of thing going on. So I tried to look at war more than just these maneuvers and things going on. I wanted to see everything in the background too, in the shadows. So
the book very much has a Starship Troopers feel for me. And when you were talking earlier about some of your early science fiction influences, I have a lot of those same influences or a lot of those same kind of reference points for the stuff I grew up reading. When you start writing a series like this, do you reconnect with those early reading experiences? And, you know, do you kind of get to feel like that you're working in that world that was so important to you when you were young?
Yeah, it's Starship Troopers are really interesting, because it's one that we've, you know, the book is really where it is. And I really enjoyed the book and stuff. And then they did the movie, which was much different in some ways, the way it presented the war and everything else. And it's just, people have become fascinated, because I remember back in the 1970s, a war book and stuff like that was really grim, dark, and everything else. But now we have heroes again. And I think that's important that we have heroes again. Not everybody agrees with what's going on. Not everybody sees it. But, you know, the warriors are actually getting a home. Because I remember when the guys came home from Vietnam, it was terrible. And these guys are coming home, and it's a much better place to be. So I wanted to bring that, but yeah, it's kind of the way, it's everything familiar. There's nothing you do that you read as a writer that doesn't touch in your work somewhere. And a lot of people worry about, well, borrowing too much here, borrowing too much there. But the thing of it is, you know, if you go look at the Iliad, it's a story about men in war. And that story has been, I think James Scott Bell told that there's two stories, men going to war and men coming home from war, which is the Iliad and the Odyssey. And, you know, it's kind of that way if you look at it. So, yeah, I think we're all part of everything we've read, consumed, been around, lived through. Yeah, it's all there.
Mel, when you're writing science fiction, it can be, depending on what kind of science fiction, it can have a lot of parallels to writing fantasy. And when we're writing fantasy, we talk a lot about world building. We talk about magic systems and the way, you know, that technology, and I'm making air quotes here, works in a fantasy series, which a lot of times comes across as magic or, you know, something like that. When you write science fiction that's far enough in the future, a lot of those lines get blurry, and the world building becomes something, you know, really fun and open-ended again, because the limits are our imagination. What sort of progress will we make between here and there? What will our technology look like? Will that, you know, just look like magic? When you're building a science fiction world that's in the future like this, what are some of the things that you try to nail down to kind of shape out the world and to make an immersive experience for readers?
Travel and communications, that seems to be the two things that everybody kind of looks at. If you go back to 1980s science fiction, they didn't really do that much. You know, they had faster than light, but nobody pointed it. They had gates and things like that. So with me, I just try to focus on that and what was coming out of that. There's a book I did in 1992, I think it came out, I can't remember, Lethal Interface. And I stuck a comm chip in a guy's head. And I thought, hey, this is cool because he can talk to headquarters and inside his head and stuff. And there was a Mac Bolan book I did back in the early 90s, right before I did the comm chip. And I wrote where Mac Bolan had the ear-throat communication device, which wasn't in anything at that point. And so I sent it in. My editor, Froze, got back to me and said, no, you can't do this. And I said, no, there's the LST-5C that was in science magazine. And I tore it out and I photocopied it to him. I said, no, this actually exists. We have this technology now. And then it wasn't long after that that everybody started supporting those. And then they put cameras on them and everything else like that. So that was just me thinking, because they also had the Land Warrior rig that they had set up for guys where they used everybody and everything else. So nobody thought about that. If you read science fiction in the 80s, body cams on cops. That's science fiction if you look at it. So who's to say what science fiction is really going to be like? So I try to look at cool ideas that they got coming on. Contact lenses that can pick up Wi-Fi and things like that. So I just play with ideas that are out there and find a way to make them as real as I can if they interest me. So, but yeah, travel and communication is big for everybody. Gaming, even in my comic books, I still haven't played video games and stuff because those things are the biggest entertainment we have right now. They have to Hollywood.
The Macomb War Book 3, Warlord, is out everywhere now, like we said, in mass market paperback. Also, Kindle edition. Is it out in audio as well?
I don't know yet, Hank. The first two have been, so I assume it will be at some point in here, but I don't know for sure.
Gotcha. I listened to the first one on audio, and it was fantastic. So I'm hoping that Book 3 gets here quickly because – I love to go back and listen to audio sometimes if I'm really connected with a book. So yeah, here's hoping for that. Is this the finish of the series? Or do you have any other plans for this world and these characters?
I have other plans. The publisher hasn't pulled the trigger on it, so we'll have to see. And I've got other things I'm developing, other things I'm working on because of the whole ADHD thing. But I've had people that contact me go, they're not done with Frank Sage, and I really think I'm not either. So it's just a matter. We've got to wait. I think we're waiting 6 months or so to see what the publisher says after they get some of the initial numbers in on this book. And then my agent's going to approach me. He's already approached me. They go, let us wait like 6 months. So because Hollywood is a hurry up and wait thing. It always has been. It's even worse now. Or not Hollywood, but New York. So it's a hurry up and wait thing. So I don't know, Hank. I mean, it's the future's still being written.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Hollywood, I would love to see this as a movie series, or even as a like an Amazon Prime series or something. That would be amazing.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It would be fun to do and fun to see.
It sure would. Well, Mel, if folks are just learning about you and all the stuff that you do, is there a place where they can, you know, dig into your back catalog and find out all about you and connect with you online?
Well, I'm on Facebook, and during the summer you get all the pictures of my gardens. People, for some reason, flip out over the garden pictures, which is great because the year I built my greenhouse, they really loved that. But so on Facebook, you can go to melodumbooks.com, and you can find me there. I try to blog somewhat irregularly. Mainly I write, but there's also a place called fantasticfiction.com that will list most of everything I've done that's been revealed under my name, because I've done a lot of things that are not under my name. So.
Gotcha. Well, we'll put links to all of that in the show notes, as well as to the Macomb War Book 3, Warlord, out now. We'll also link up Books 1 and 2, because you definitely want to get in on the beginning of this series. I love it so much, Mel, and I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Oh, Hank, thank you.
Stay tuned now for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War.
The near future. Humanity's only hope of survival entered the solar system at nearly the speed of light. The probe slowed as the sun's heliosphere disrupted the graviton wave it rode in on from the abyss of deep space. Awakened by the sudden deceleration, The probe absorbed the electromagnetic spectrum utilized by its target species and assessed the technological sophistication of the sole sentient species on Earth. The probe adjusted its course to take it into the system's primary. If the humans couldn't survive, with its help, what was to come? Then the probe would annihilate itself. There would be no trace of it for the enemy, and no chance of humanity's existence beyond the time it had until the enemy arrived. The probe analyzed filed patents, military expenditures, birth rates, mathematical advancement, and space exploration. The first assessment fell within the margin of error of survival and extinction for humanity. The probe's programming allowed for limited, autonomous decision-making, choice being a rare luxury for the probe's class of artificial intelligence. The probe found itself in a position to choose between ending its mission in the sun's fire and a mathematically improbable defense of humanity, and the potential compromise of its much larger mission. Given the rare opportunity to make its own decision, the probe opted to dither. In the week it took to pass into Jupiter's orbit, the probe took in more data. It scoured the internet for factors to add to the assessment, but the assessment remained the same. Unlikely, but possible. By the time it shot past Mars, the probe still hadn't made a decision. As the time to adjust course for Earth or continue into the sun approached, the probe conducted a final scan of cloud storage servers for any new information and found something interesting. While the new information made only a negligible impact on the assessment, the probe adjusted course to Earth. It hadn't traveled all this way for nothing. In the desert south of Phoenix, Arizona, it landed with no more fanfare than a slight thump and a few startled cows. Then it broke into the local cell network and made a call. Mark Ibarra awoke to his phone ringing at max volume, playing a pop ditty that he hated with vehemence. He rolled off the mattress that lay on the floor and crawled on his hands and knees to where his cell was recharging. His roommate, who paid the majority of their rent and got to sleep on an actual bed, grumbled and let off a slew of slurred insults. Mark reached his cell and slapped at it until the offending music ended. He blinked sleep from his eyes and tried to focus on the caller's name on the screen. The only people who'd call at this ungodly hour were his family in Basque country, or maybe Jessica in his applied robotics course, wanted a late-night study break. The name on the screen was Answer Me. He closed an eye and reread the name. It was way too early, or too late, depending on one's point of view, for this nonsense. He turned the ringer off and went back to bed. Sleep was about to claim him when the phone rang again, just as loudly as last time, but now with a disco anthem.
Seriously?
His roommate slurred. Mark declined the call and powered the phone off. He flopped back on his bed and curled into his blanket.
To hell with my first class, he thought.
Arizona State University had a lax attendance policy, one which he'd abused for nights like this. The cell erupted with big band music. Mark took his head out from beneath the covers and looked at his phone like it was a thing possessed. The phone vibrated so hard that it practically danced a jig on the floor, and the screen flashed Answer Me over and over again as music blared.
Dude,
said his roommate, now sitting up in his bed. Mark swiped the phone off the charging cord, and the music stopped. The caller's name undulated with a rainbow of colors, and an arrow appeared on the screen, pointing to the button he had to press to answer the call.
When did I get this app?
He thought. Mark sighed and left the bedroom, meandering into the hallway bathroom with the grace of a zombie. The battered mattress he slept on played hell with his back, and left him stiff every morning. Dropping his boxers, he took a seat on the toilet and answered the call, determined to return this caller's civility with some interesting background noise.
"What?" he murmured.
"Mark Ibarra, I need to see you." The voice was mechanical, asexual in its monotone.
"Do you have any friggin' idea what time it is? Wait, who the hell is this?"
"You must come to me immediately. We must discuss the mathematical proof you have stored in document title This Can't Be Right, dot doc." Mark shot to his feet. The boxers around his ankles tripped him up, and he stumbled out of the bathroom and fell against the wall. His elbow punched a hole in the drywall, and the cell clattered to the floor. He scooped the phone back up and struggled to breathe as a sudden asthma attack came over him.
How?
He couldn't finish his question until he found his inhaler in the kitchen, mere steps away in the tiny apartment. He took a deep breath from the inhaler and felt the tightness leave his lungs. That someone knew of his proof was impossible. He'd finished it earlier that night and had encrypted it several times before loading it into a cloud file that shouldn't have been linked to him in any way.
"How do you know about that?"
he asked. "You must come to me immediately. There is little time. Look at your screen," the robotic voice said. His screen changed to a map program, displaying a pin in an open field just off the highway, connecting Phoenix to the suburb of Maricopa. "Come. Now." Mark grabbed his keys. An hour later, his jeans ripped from scaling a barbed wire fence, Mark was surrounded by desert scrub. The blue of the morning rose behind him, where his beat-up Honda waited on the side of the highway. With his cell to his ear, Mark stopped and looked around before deciding how to continue. Spiked ocotillo plants looked a lot like benign mesquite trees in the darkness. A Native American casino in the distance served as his North Star, helping him keep his bearings.
"You're not out here, are you? I'm being punked, aren't I?"
he asked the mysterious caller. "You are 9.26 meters to my east-southeast. Punk, decayed wood, used as tinder. Are you on fire?" the caller said. Mark rolled his eyes. This wasn't the first time the caller had used the non-standard meanings of words during what passed as conversation between the two. Mark had tried to get the caller to explain how he knew about his theorem and why they had to meet in the middle of the desert. The caller had refused to say anything. He would only reiterate that Mark had to come quickly to see him, chiding him every time Mark deviated from the provided driving directions.
"If you're so close, why can't I see you?"
he asked. He took a few steps in what he thought was a northwesterly direction and squished into a cow patty.